You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Hands up if you think of yourself as salt. No? Hands up if you think of yourself as light. No? No? Neither do I. I don't tend to think of myself in those terms. Mostly if I can get through a day with doing all the things that I have to do and without forgetting some major commitment or burning the supper, I count that as a triumph. Life is busy, and it's easy to feel overwhelmed by all the things that we have to do. How on top of the daily chores are we to find time to be salt and light? Yet we know that that's what we're called to be. It seems like a bit of an intimidating challenge, doesn't it? But it really shouldn't be, and hopefully you'll agree that it isn't after we've explored this passage from Matthew for a bit. Salt and light is a shorthand phrase we sometimes hear in relation to what we as Christians should be. But what did Jesus mean? Clearly, salt and light are symbols, but what are they symbols of? Why did he choose those particular things? Let's look first of all at salt and its significance in the place where and the time when Jesus was alive. Salt was a very important commodity, not because it was rare. Often nowadays, we think of rarity and importance as going hand in hand. Gold, platinum, diamonds, these are precious commodities, and part of their value lies in their rarity, the fact that they're difficult to come by. Not so for salt in Judea. Can anyone name the sea lake which is on the eastern border of what was known as Judea? That's it. There's a couple of slides that, if you go into the second one, you can see along here. Does anyone know the most famous thing about the Dead Sea? Fun fact. You can float in it. Why can you float in it? Lots of salt. It's what's known as a hypersaline lake. Hypersaline basically just means very salty. It would from time to time flood, and when the floodwaters receded and all the water evaporated, coarse-grained salt would be left behind on the shores of the lake. If you look closely at the shoreline on the slide, you can see the salt on the shoreline. It almost looks like snow, doesn't it? So there was never a shortage of salt in Judea. You could literally scoop it off the ground. And what's more, if you wanted to flavour food with salt, you didn't need a lot of it. You only needed a tiny amount in comparison to the amount of food you were seasoning to make a big difference to the taste. So rarity didn't explain its importance. What did explain it? Well, all the reasons it's still important today, but with an added twist. We think of salt as important because it's the most used seasoning in food, and that's the same for the Jewish people. It was used to add flavour. Not only that, but it was used to preserve meat, fish and vegetables. Remember, they didn't have fridges and freezers to do that job. And because it's an antiseptic, as Cassie mentioned, that meant it was used as a medicine as well to ward off infection. It was not only used to season cooked food, it was also used in the cooking process itself. Salt was used in the clay ovens typically found in the Middle East, which were fueled not by wood, but by dried out dung. If any of the younger kids aren't sure what dung is, please don't ask your parents until after the brunch. That's definitely a conversation that can wait till later. Salt was added to the top of the dung to make it burn hotter and more evenly. But over time, the salt lost its ability to assist the even burning of the fuel and it had to be thrown away. This, no doubt, is what Jesus was referring to when he spoke about salt losing its flavour. Flavour probably meant essential properties rather than taste. I doubt anyone was tempted to taste the salt which had been cooked on top of a dung fire. Those are the practical reasons why salt was important. But that isn't the whole story. The Jews also believed that salt was important because for them it was an important religious symbol. It was considered a vital component in the temple sacrifice system. In fact, only meat seasoned with salt could be used in burnt offerings. And so great quantities of salt were needed for temple sacrifice. In the Old Testament book of Leviticus, the expression salt of the covenant is used, showing that salt was a symbol of the covenant between God and Israel. Particularly holy and unbreakable promises were known as salt covenants. Apparently, even today, Middle Eastern people use the phrase, there is salt between us, to show that there's a special bond or covenant between two people. This symbolic understanding of salt is recognised in the Jewish Talmud that records the teachings of the rabbis. The rabbis liken salt to the Torah. That's the law found in the first five books of the Old Testament. The reasoning was that just as the world cannot do without salt, neither could it do without the Torah. Notice how universal and inclusive this teaching is. They aren't just saying that the Jews need the law, they're saying the world needs the law. So it's against that background that we consider the use of salt as a symbol by Jesus. The important things to note are, salt was an everyday, readily available resource in Jesus' time. It wasn't rare, it was common. Salt helped in various different practical ways to make daily life easier, better, and more enjoyable. Salt was a symbol of the special relationship between God and God's people. So if we can just hold those things in our minds for the moment, because we're going to tie everything up at the end, but I'd like to turn to what Jesus said about light and ask, why would he use light as a symbol for what we should be? Well, he uses two symbols, actually, a city on a hill and a lamp on a lampstand. But the point is the same. A city on a hill would cast lights across the surrounding countryside. A lamp would light up the whole of a room. These are things which penetrate. They're not hidden, but spread out from their point of origin to touch everything in their path. They're not directed at one person. Anyone within the area of their reach is affected by them. That's the nature of light. It spreads out in all directions and lights up everything around it. So now we have an idea of the qualities of salt and light which we can imagine Jesus had in mind when he used them in this teaching. How do we apply these to ourselves? If we are to be salt, we can understand that we don't have to be anything special. We don't have to be rare or precious or have unusual abilities. The thing which is important is a thing which is commonly found in people generally. That is, we can make a difference in different ways, and we can make life better and more enjoyable, not by being unusually gifted, but just by being ourselves, by being as useful and practical as everyday common or garden salt. But we have to bear in mind that it's also possible not to be useful. Being salt, symbolically speaking, doesn't of itself guarantee that we can serve the intended purpose. We have to use our essential nature for God's purposes in order to be useful in the way that Jesus calls us to be. We have to remember and be the salt of the covenant. Our usefulness depends on our relationship with God. So we need to nurture that relationship because that's what guides us as to what we should be doing. Of course, it's possible not to do God's work, but it's also possible to do too much, to use up our resources so that we've nothing left to give. Just like the salt, which can no longer assist in the burning of the fuel. We need to use our resources wisely, recognising that they are finite. If we are to be light, we must understand that we are to spread our light around, not keep it to ourselves or direct it only to a select few. Everyone who comes into contact with us should benefit. Everyone should be able to see the light shining from us. Now, that might seem like a big ask, to light up everything and everyone we come into contact with. But we should remember that this calling goes hand in hand with the calling to be salt. Common, everyday, nothing fancy salt. We can be ourselves and still be lights to the world. We just have to remember to spread the good things around. Bearing these things in mind helps when we are confronted by overwhelming problems. We know that many people in various parts of the world are suffering. We know that there are wars and natural disasters, and there's poverty and disease. What can we do? How can we make a difference when the problem seems so huge and complex? Well, that's not for us to worry about. We aren't called on an individual basis to solve all of the world's problems. We are called to be salt and light, ordinary, commonplace, nothing special people, spreading what light we have in all directions. When we make up a shoebox, it can seem like a small thing. And it is. In the grand scheme of things, it isn't earth-shattering. But does that mean that it's an insignificant thing? When we take part in the annual ritual of putting little gifts in a cardboard box wrapped in Christmas paper, are we not reminded of people in other parts of the world who we might not usually think of? And are our hearts not softened by this? And when we hand in our boxes, they're checked by volunteers, all of whom have their part to play in this little gesture. And those boxes, once checked, are transported hundreds of miles by yet more people, all of whom are playing their part. And then they're received by workers on the ground for distribution, all of whom are playing their part. And eventually, the box you packed is put in the hands of some person who might otherwise never have known how far a light can reach when it is shone by ordinary, nothing special people. People who Jesus would have called the salt of the earth. So I think we shouldn't ever be embarrassed or feel too intimidated to think of ourselves as salt and light. Everyone here can be those things. And when you add up all of those little individual lights together, is it too much to hope that it might just be possible to eventually light up the whole world? Let's hope and pray that that isn't an impossible dream. Amen. Amen.